from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in the next hour of the Forum program, Piper Kerman was like many upper-middle-class New Yorkers with a wedding to plan until her adventurous youth caught up with her and she found herself in prison for money laundering. Kerman's memoir, Orange is the New Black, which has been turned into a popular Netflix series, follows her years spent in a women's prison. She'll join us in the studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. At age 24, Piper Kerman, an upper-middle-class New Yorker, was a Smith graduate involved in a relationship with another woman. And in 1993, under the influence of that woman, she flew to Belgium with a suitcase of money for a West African drug lord. 5 years later, she was named as part of a drug ring, and in 2004, after a six-year delay, she went to serve 14 months in the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut. An adaptation of her story, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, has been adapted to become a popular Netflix series, and Piper Kerman joins us in studio for the second hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you. I guess the first question, and probably you've been asked this many times, is what were you thinking? I mean, this is a former incarnation or former avatar. You know, you've left it behind. You've gone on to become, in so many ways, a different person. But mm-hmm. can you put yourself into that 24-year-old girl's mind?
Sure. I mean, I met my ex-lover, you know, before I was 24. But, you know, when I was fresh out of college, like many young people, a little unclear on what my next steps were and pretty green, pretty naive in a lot of senses. I wanted all of the sort of danger and glamour and intrigue and adventure that she offered. And, you know, she simply made me an offer and I took it. And
paid the piper. You should forgive the bad pun.
You know, well, karma, we all know what they say about karma. And truthfully, you know, the consequences of our actions come back to us in one form or another. And in my case, it was the knock on the door many years later from federal agents letting me know that it was time to pay the piper.
10-year delay, in fact, wasn't it?
It was about a 5-year delay for the indictment. And then there was a very lengthy legal delay of almost 6 years. So I actually walked through prison gates 11 years after committing a crime.
And you actually, by that time, were engaged to a man and were leading a very sober kind of life, I suppose, by most standards.
You know, when I carried that bag of money from Chicago to Brussels, it was, you know, it scared the pants off me. It was a really frightening experience. So very shortly after that, I ended that relationship. I made my way back to the United States, right here to San Francisco, actually. I sort of crash landed here in the early 90s and met up with college friends and sort of got myself back on track, back on what might have been the more anticipated track for me. And in the course of that, I met, you know, my now husband, Larry Smith, here in San Francisco, and started a career, worked for a production company here in the city, and really felt like I had put that crazy experience in the lockbox at the back of the closet. Not literally the closet. But, you know, it came back roaring with fangs and big teeth.
And you met your former lover in prison, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, one thing came to another. And during the 13 months, I served 13 months of a 15-month sentence. During that time, we ended up coming face to face. That was a very, very intense kind of a confrontation, but one that I am grateful for because it actually allowed me to get to a place where I relinquished all blame that I might have assigned to her and took full responsibility for myself. You know, we did end up sharing a cell along with, you know, four other women, which was close quarters, and you really definitely get the opportunity to work out some issues in those situations.
There have been some strange issues that have surfaced in light of the success. And, you know, there's always going to be schadenfreude and jealousy because you've had a lot of success with the memoir and with the memoir being made into a film. But surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, I'd like you to comment on this. A lot of comments that I happen to be reading said, you know, she's getting all this attention because she's a white privileged woman and, you know, graduate of Smith and all that sort of thing, as opposed to all of the and you've drawn attention certainly to all the people that went to prison with you, but all of the people who have prison stories who would not get that attention if they didn't come from the class background that you came from.
Yeah. So in this country, you know, we have the biggest prison population by far in the entire world and probably the biggest prison population in human history. You know, about 2.3 million people in prison, 7 million people under correctional control, many, many millions of other Americans whose lives are affected very powerfully by the criminal justice system. Overwhelmingly, those folks come from our most vulnerable and low-income communities and disproportionately communities of color. There is no question about that. The numbers are very, very clear. So it is definitely true that a quote-unquote fish-out-of-water story of, you know, a middle-class, upper-middle-class woman who is plunged into a public system which is very much reserved for low-income people and, you know, people of color by and large. You know, very few wealthy people go to prison in this country. Overwhelmingly poor people and disproportionately poor people of color are sent to prison or to jail in this country.
The other thing you often read, though, is that federal prisons are, in fact, I remember they used to talk about them as country clubs, which may be absurd, but on the face of it, but, you know, certainly not like the penitentiaries, not like hard time done by, say, people here in Quentin and that sort of thing. Yeah. And in fact, you know, in many people's minds, though, there's a hole and there's solitary. It's a walk in the park compared to or even compared to something represented by a series like Oz on television, which your Netflix show has been compared to on a number of occasions.
In contrast, I think. It's very, very different than Oz. Certainly, if you're unfortunate enough to land in prison, the best case scenario is probably a low-security women's federal facility, like one of the facilities that I was held in while I was incarcerated. I was also held in a federal jail, which is the worst place I've ever been in my life. And yet, that was in Chicago, and some of the other women, there was no shoe for women in that particular facility. So if a woman got in trouble, a female prisoner got in trouble in that facility, they sent you to the Cook County Jail. And I was assured by the other prisoners that's the last place you want to be. So what that tells us is that there is this vast, it's been described as an archipelago of prisons and jails. They are very, very different. One type of institution is very different from another. And yet there are some fundamental through lines about the experience and the status of being a prisoner, the loss of liberty, the struggles with guilt and shame and contending with whatever transgression it is that landed you in prison or in jail in the first place.
Well, most of the women that you did time with, the transgression was largely drug-related. And most of these women were, I suppose, by most people's lights, what we would call ordinary women, with their own problems, of course, and their own sense of shame and all that. But, you know, part of the quotidian world we live in.
The federal system particularly has a enormous percentage of drug offenders, and many of them, like the vast majority of the women that I was incarcerated with in Danbury, are low-level nonviolent drug offenders. And 10 ounces of crack cocaine, which is about the size of a small cereal bowl, still carries a mandatory minimum sentence in this country of 10 years, which if you think about it, is insane.
This is a whole postgraduate education for you about the criminal justice system and about really incarceration, was it not?
Absolutely.
I mean, you became, and you are, I think it's safe to say, kind of an activist prison reformer now, aren't you?
You know, I make my living by writing, but you can't write about prisons and jails and not be drawn into very fundamentally political issues, whether those be issues of race and class or the literal cost of incarcerating so many people.
You make your living by writing. You're with Spitfire Strategies. You're doing communication work, aren't you, mainly?
When I came home from prison in 2005, I began to work with a firm called Spitfire Strategies, which is based in Washington, D.C. It is a public interest communications firm, so we work with nonprofits or philanthropies. So I've been doing this work, you know, with on a host of issues, not only on criminal justice, but I've been lucky enough in the last several years since the book came out to be able to focus exclusively on criminal justice.
And we're talking, if you just joined us, with Piper Kerman, the author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. Her experiences provided the basis for the comedy-drama Netflix series Orange is the New Black, and she'll be appearing at a Litquake event October 19th, Words on the Waves, at a private houseboat pier in Sausalito from 1 to 3:30, but the event is sold out, so why am I announcing it? to let you know that she's in town for this, and also to give a plug to Litquake, which we're big supporters of and have been throughout the past. This is an adaptation. The Netflix show has been very popular, and I wanted listeners to get just a little taste of it. By an adaptation, they took the usual shall we say, poetic or fictional licenses, to be sure, from your book. But you write early on about learning the rules of prison life. And this is actually a clip where the character, Piper Chapman, as she's called, learns there are a lot of unspoken rules that she needs to learn. And this is her meeting some of those new cellmates.
Tell me your name again.
Piper. Chapman.
That's Miss Rosa. And that's Nichols. Just got out of shoe a week ago. Told the CO to kiss her ass. Dumb. Might make trouble for yourself, you know?
Shoe, that's solitary?
Yep. And you don't want it, honey. Trust me. Here's some toilet paper. Gotta take it with you. Don't make it bad!
What?
We'll make it for you.
Oh, no, that's okay. You don't need to do that.
Honey, we'll make the bed. We know how.
I know how to make a bed.
We know how to do it, so we'll pass inspection. You can help clean. We clean everything with maxi pads.
Seriously?
Yep, that's a head scratcher, but that's what we got.
So we make our beds in the morning before they
can. You sleep on top of the bed with the blanket over you.
What if I want to sleep in the bed?
Look, you can do what you want, but you will be the only one in this entire prison that does. You want that? Be my guest.
That's from the first episode of Orange is the New Black, when Piper Chapman is meeting her cellmates and learning the rules. And that's pretty close to the bone of what you went through.
I mean, that particular scene is close to verbatim from the book. And it always makes me laugh. And the first time I watched it, I had a funny feeling just because it did transport me back to room 6 in the Danbury Federal Prison Camp. The show takes many, many liberties and makes many dramatic departures from the true story that is depicted in the book, that is told in the book. But the thing that makes me happy about the show and that that scene demonstrates is that they've worked really hard to create an environment in the fictional prison of Litchfield, which is true to the experience of being incarcerated in a low-security women's prison in the federal system.
And they being, for the most part, the same people that gave us weed.
Jenji Kohan is the woman who created Weeds, and she read the book in 2010 when it first came out and got in touch with me and said, I want to take this on as my next project. And I was pretty thrilled by that.
And it has vaulted you into a position where you can talk about things like prison reform. So let's do that for a moment. I mean, just from your experience, it's not about rehabilitation. Probably doesn't even resemble anything close to rehabilitation. About warehousing and maybe punishment, and that's about it.
The American correctional system is undoubtedly punitive. No one needs to worry about that. And as we have built up this enormous prison population over the last approximately 30 years, mainly due to drug sentencing, but there are a couple other factors that also contribute to the size of our prison population. Not only is it punitive, it is also warehousing to an extent that is truly mind-boggling once you actually get behind prison walls. Just people stacked on top of each other, literally killing time. And nowhere is that more starkly on display, obviously, than here in California, where you know, the prison system has been under sort of federal oversight for a number of years.
And where Pelican Bay is going through all these throes of agony over the shoe.
Over the shoe, yeah, absolutely.
There's also, though, I mean, we talk about how dreadful prison is and doing time. I always think about Waiting for Godot. It's kind of, you know, I mean, it was one of the first performances was at San Quentin, and those people knew exactly what that play was communicating. But there's also, and this comes across in your narratives and in the Netflix series, a sense of camaraderie, almost a familial sense. I mean, one doesn't want to get sentimental or nostalgic mm-hmm. about it, but it's real, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is a community, whether people, I mean, it's an obviously a totally involuntary community, but a community nonetheless. And so folks have absolutely no choice but to contend with one another. And even though there is a great deal of loneliness and sometimes stoicism or the need to sort of, you know, there's a prison trope, you know, you walk in here alone, you walk out alone. I personally think that it's bull because you're not alone at all. You're quite the opposite. There's zero privacy in prison. And you must find out where you fit in the social ecology of whatever prison or jail you live within. Most prisoners are very quick to say, this is not my home. But for 10 years, you have to make it the place that you live. And so people, of course, find all sorts of ways to do that, both positive and negative. You know, folks do say that female prisoners are a little bit more, you know, community-minded than male prisoners. You know, I have only been behind the walls of a few men's prisons. They're fascinating places as well. But I think that there are, again, some fundamental through lines and universal truths to the experience of incarceration.
Well, from your experiences, especially having gone into some male prisons, what would you think of in terms of triage if you were suggesting, recommending, maybe even dictating where California prisons are concerned, where the penal institutions here are concerned?
As the Supreme Court, you know, made very tersely clear this week, you know, California has no choice really but to adopt some front-end reform that sends fewer people into the system in the first place. And so, you know, I'm not an expert on the California system, and I'm sure many of your guests who are listening, I mean, excuse me, your listeners, know far more about the California system than I may. But what has been sort of troubling to watch is how, you know, policymakers have headed towards truly bad decisions of how do we get to a place where we can release people who may or may not be prepared for release? Or how do we get to a place where we can ship people out of state to private prisons, which is a disaster, whether you're talking about economics or, you know, the humane treatment of individual people, as opposed to really focusing on the politically challenging but very necessary next step of how do we change our laws and our sentencing guidelines so that we send fewer people to prison in the first place. And most especially, you know, the low end of the system, nonviolent drug offenders, low, you know, there's thousands of people in California prisons and jails who are there for essentially simple possession. And there's many, many proven ways that are better to deal with folks who are dealing with substance abuse or either at the same time or as an alternative, folks who deal with mental illness, some really consistent things that put people into the criminal justice system, than confinement. And I can tell you from personal experience, because women disproportionately suffer from mental illness and substance abuse and end up into the criminal justice system in those ways, confinement and the conditions of incarceration do not improve mental illness. They make it worse.
Yeah, we did a whole program on that. In fact, it's in our archives if anybody would like to avail themselves of it. I'm getting some comments here from listeners, and you'll have an opportunity to speak with Piper Kerman as well as to post your comments and so forth. In fact, let me tell you how you can do that right now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and it's 866-733-6786. So we do welcome you to this conversation. If you have thoughts or questions or comments, please feel free to express them. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us, our Twitter handle @kqedforum. And a listener writes, Piper, please don't take offense, but I'm way more interested in the other characters on the show. Was that part of your hope with the book? And how many of the Netflix characters are inspired by real people? I love Crazy Eyes.
Mm.
You know that Larry David had a character named Crazy Eyes, too, in Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I don't recall that. I wonder which season that was. I did like that show.
But how many are inspired by real characters? Most of them, aren't they?
Well, it's an adaptation. So there are certain characters that, you know, if you read my book, there is a person who I dub Crazy Eyes. There is a person who I nickname Pensatucky. The characters in the show are very different than those real people as they're depicted in the book. Genji, as I said, takes creative liberties and changes and adapts those characters in all kinds of ways. To the central question from the listener, though, my belief when I decided to write the book, which I did after I came home from prison, was that by telling my own story, I would possibly be able to get folks to come and read a prison book who might not otherwise pick one up. And if they did that, they would meet, in the course of reading that book, an amazing, fascinating group of women. You know, I miss nothing about prison other than the people that I met there. And I'm good friends still with some of the women who I was locked up with. And there's other women who have sort of disappeared into the ether, and I think about them often. But what is wonderful to me about the creative choices that Jenji made in the show is that she took that even further. You know, she didn't choose to focus on a single protagonist, but rather she recognized that every single person in a prison or a jail is the protagonist of their own story, even though from the outside, we don't always think about people who have been locked up in that way.
Well, we'll hear a clip of Crazy Eyes, so I'd like listeners to hear. But before I do that, you were particularly, I think, pleased with the transgender character and the way she was portrayed.
Very much so. While I was incarcerated, there was a transgendered woman who was placed into the unit that I lived in, and she was a really interesting, a lovely woman, very gracious and graceful, I thought, in terms of her very singular position within that unit of about 200 women. And she ended up being my neighbor, living, you know, literally right next door to me in the next bunk over. The character of Sophia Bursette on the show is very different than the character who I call Vanessa, you know, the person, the real person I call Vanessa in the book. I was thrilled, I wouldn't say surprised, but definitely thrilled that Jenji chose to have a transgendered character, and that in Sophia Bursette, she has just, you know, busted open so many fascinating questions about, you know, gender and identity, and also about the way that, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people are treated by the correctional system, which is kind of horrifying. So,
well,
thrilling.
I promised a cut from Crazy Eyes. And by the way, just for the record, it was Crazy Eyes Killer is the name in the Curb Your Enthusiasm, Wanda's boyfriend. But this is Piper earning the admiration of this woman nicknamed Crazy Eyes, who is an African-American woman who calls Piper her prison wife. And she seems to always pop up when the character Piper least expects it, like in this scene when Piper is running on the prison track.
Hello, baby! Look at you getting your sweat on. You look how shiny. I bet you don't even smell funky. Oh, I knew you wouldn't. You a real woman, Chapman, a real grown woman. And not like all these other girls around here. I can't waste my time with these silly bitches. I need a real woman.
Sure that you'll find one.
I wrote a poem. You want to hear?
You know, that's fine.
Before I met you, the sun was like a yellow grape. But now it looked like fire in the sky. Why? Because you light a fire inside me. I wrote it for you.
You know, my fiance is a writer.
I'm going to call you Dandelion. Because they're pretty and yellow, just like you.
Well, later on in that same scene, a prison guard tells them they have to get their swirl on somewhere else, meaning chocolate and vanilla. And when Piper asks what a squirrel is, Crazy Eyes grasps her hand and starts singing Chocolate and Vanilla Swirl. We'll come back and we'll hear from you again, our listeners. If you are a fan of the show, if you're familiar with it, certainly, or if you've read the book, we'd like to hear your thoughts about it, and join us with any questions or comments you might have. You can go to our Facebook page. You can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. And again, you can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Spending the hour with Piper Kerman, her book again, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour is Piper Kerman, who is, like I suppose many upper-middle-class New Yorkers, with a wedding to plan until her adventurous youth caught up with her and she found herself in prison for money laundering. And her memoir, Orange is the New Black, has been turned into a popular Netflix series. It follows her year spent in a women's prison, and she's here in the Bay Area for Litquake. And here's a tweet that says, as a fellow Seven Sisters alumna, I'm curious what parallels Piper observed between the all-women populations in both college and prison.
Mm. I write in the book that I suspect that I was much more prepared in some ways than some other women for life in a essentially women's community within a women's prison, even though the differences between a fancy women's college and a women's prison are very stark. I often reflect upon the fact that we build some institutions for certain people and other institutions for others. And sometimes folks from one path or the other never get the opportunity to – opportunity might seem like a strange word – but the opportunity to recognize that. That's a disturbing sort of social reality that – that's a really intentional social choice to build one type of institution versus another. And as we see people, you know, state governments and governments in general spend more and more money on prisons and less money on schools, the chickens come home to roost.
A couple of comments from listeners, then we'll go to calls, that curiously have a similar motif here about disbelief. Alex writes, Piper's character doesn't seem real to me. Middle-class educated woman who falls into the random drama of prison life. Come on. And another listener, Cecilia, writes, was Piper truly as clueless when she went into prison as the show portrays her?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to be so objective as to answer that. Perhaps not. I had 6 years of waiting in between the time that I knew that I would serve a prison sentence and actually walking into prison gates. So by the day that I actually walked into those gates, I was very much like, let's get it over with. I don't know if anything could really prepare someone who had really limited exposure to the criminal justice system for the realities of the criminal justice system, whether you're talking about what transpires in our courtrooms or behind the walls of prisons and jails. I think it's extremely eye-opening to have the actual personal experience. And I think that the stories, you know, of people who have had those experiences, whether it's an experience like mine or a very different one like the one related by Joe Loya in his book, The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, those narratives are, I think, the most essential way to try to understand this vast, vast criminal justice system and prison system that we've built up in this country.
Joe Loya introduced you at Booksmith here in San Francisco with a very, laudatory, to put it mildly, introduction about you and your work. And here's some criticism. It's always available to us, whoever the guest is. But I'm just curious to get your response. So sure. Rick from Palo Alto, who says, your guest spouts the common liberal shibboleth about prison being unfair because it has a large population of minorities. Considering all the hurdles required to put someone behind bars for years of punishment, it seems a little disingenuous to believe this. Moreover, prisons do serve a good cause, that being the prevention of future crimes.
The idea that there are a lot of hurdles to putting someone in prison is, at least from my point of view, ludicrous. I will say a couple of points not to get really wonky. But if a person is arrested, one of the very first things that happens, if anyone thinks about sort of what might that process be. So you may be arrested with or without, you know, appropriately or inappropriately. But someone who is arrested has not yet been convicted of a crime, but they may be held in jail. And what often happens is that they may be assigned bail. If they are poor and 80% of criminal defendants are too poor to afford a lawyer, then they may not be able to afford that bail. And several things happen often right away. If they have a job, they probably lose that job almost immediately because they're not able to show up for that job. The other things that happen often when someone is not able to afford their bail is that they may lose their housing. They may lose custody of their children. There's a whole cascade of catastrophic things that are happening outside of the walls of that jail and outside of their control. And what that does very often is that people plead out of desperation to get out of jail. So they may be offered a deal along the lines of, you know, probation but no more jail time. And they take it, but then they're in the criminal justice system, and that continues to have all kinds of negative consequences, like the loss of the right to vote and many, many significant barriers to employment. The other really, really significant thing that presses people into the criminal justice system and actually, you know, flies in the face of your listener's comment is the state of public defense. So first and foremost, someone's taken into custody, possibly put in jail. Maybe they can't afford their bail because they're part of that 80% of criminal defendants too poor to afford a lawyer. If you're too poor to afford a lawyer, you may wait and wait and wait for a very long time before you are appointed either a public defender or, you know, outside court-appointed counsel. And the quality of the public defense services vary dramatically from state to state and even in county, from county to county. And so if you're accused of a crime in the city of San Francisco, you will get a very good public defender. Or in San Mateo, for example, you'll get a very good public defender or an appointed counsel. But in another county in California, that may not be the case.
I don't know if you're familiar with Ayelet Waldman's work at all.
I am very familiar with Ayelet Waldman.
The reason I mention it is you know, certainly a lot of these women who do time for drug offenses and everything are pretty much railroaded, as she's made clear in a lot of her work, both fiction and nonfiction, or they take the rap, they're with boyfriends or whatever the case may be.
Spouses.
In effect, a lot of the men who should be prosecuted are not ultimate. In fact, this West African drug lord, he never did any time, did he?
No. He was taken into custody in the United Kingdom on this U.S. warrant. But ultimately, the U.K. declined to extradite him to the United States and set him free instead. So, you know, as you describe, it's absolutely true that many women in the system particularly have a relationship that has helped place them behind bars. So, for example, one of my bunkies, you know, Faith, ultimately, you know, made this sort of family decision to sort of take the rap for her husband because he was looking at a lot more time because he had prior offenses.
And some of these women have children and they're, you know.
Most women have children,
Worried about the kids and foster homes and all of those kinds of things. I mean, it's just, well, let me get to our callers because lots of people want to talk to you and we'll get as many of you on as we can. We begin, Suzanne, with you. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Suzanne.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Piper. This is great. I taught in prison. I taught art in prison in California, in men's prison and in the women's prison in Dublin, the federal prison.
And I know it, yes.
I think everyone should have to go into prison because I had no idea until I did that job what it was like. I had no clue. It was just completely opened my mind. But the question I had was, one of the things I noticed was I felt there was an element of sexual harassment that happened at times. And I don't think the women knew. They didn't have to take it. And
this is Suzanne, by the men, you mean, yeah.
Yeah, by the male guards. And I don't think the guards probably ever had to go through sexual... Well, maybe they do, but I wondered if Piper saw that happening and...
Yes. In every single women's prison or jail in this country, there is a problem with sexual abuse and sexual assault. And so there is very typical, ordinary, day-to-day things that happen to practically every prisoner, like groping. You know, I certainly experienced that during the time that I was incarcerated, things that no woman would really ever want to tolerate, you know, on the outside world and that everyone just puts up with. And then, of course, there are the more extreme examples of rape or of sexual relationships which are fundamentally abusive. Everyone behind the walls of a prison or a jail knows that sexual contact of any type is against the rules. So certainly the guards and staff know. It's a very, very prevalent problem. And rape and sexual abuse in all kinds of prisons and jails is an epidemic problem. But for women in the criminal justice system, they are much more likely to be under threat from a staffer than from another prisoner.
And Suzanne, we thank you for your call. We want to move on to more of your calls, and we welcome Kareem. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Okay.
Hi, Kareem.
So I loved the book, and I loved the show. And very coincidentally, I'm part of an organization that's hosting Michelle Alexander to talk about her work on the new Jim Crow this evening.
Fantastic.
And yeah, I'm very excited.
Prison and Colorblindness, yeah.
Yeah, mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. But, you know, there's been such a strong reaction to how the women on the show, the women of color, the Latina and black women, are portrayed. And I'm wondering if you've had contact with any of the people that you serve time with and what their reaction to the show and the book has been.
Mm-hmm. I do have contact with some of the women that I did time with. Some of those women I've stayed, you know, quite close with over the years since I came home. Some of those women have, sort of come up either after the book came up or after the show came out. From the people who have been in touch with me, I have gotten only positive reactions. So no one has gotten in touch with me and been upset or angry about either the portrayal of themselves or someone they knew or sort of the broader question. The response that I get from the women who I did time with is that they are thrilled that somebody wrote a book about this, because the world of prisons and jails, as the previous caller said, is very hidden and very different from what is typically portrayed in the media. And compounding upon that, you know, the situation for women and girls in prisons and jails is also sort of even less frequently commented upon or noticed.
There's a sense of you're going into this experience and having fresh eyes, almost like a reporter and being exposed to something that you could process and you could do what you've done with, which is to say, write about it. Although I know a lot of the initial reason for writing had to do with the fact that people were asking you and were really curious, and that was a good catalyst. But there's a sense, when people get out of this, what you called lockbox that you had, of just welcoming the freedom and being, you know, exuberant about it. And yet there are a lot of people who can't live outside of the prisons. I mean, they keep going back because they can't stand or can't adapt to what's out there.
Well, one of the incredibly frustrating things about the ever-lengthening sentencing approaches in this country is that they are counterproductive. There have been some studies that show that sometimes short, predictable, and, you know, perceived as fair incarceration can be somewhat effective, especially for sort of folks who are churning through at a low level as opposed to committing very serious felonies. But what is really, really clear is that locking someone away for a very long period of time, taking them out of the community entirely, placing them in an overwhelmingly structured environment where they have very little agency or choice, has this incredibly counterproductive effect when they then return to the community, because they've been away from their family, away from any networks that they have for such a very long period of time that those personal relationships are frayed, sometimes to the point of being irreparable.
They also
and it's
have
so hard
they
to
have
return.
A stigma. I mean, it's very difficult for them to even get work in many instances.
Oh, yeah. Employment, you know, I would say employment and housing are generally the two biggest stumbling blocks to successful reentry. But I guess my point is, when we think about what are appropriate punishments, if we're going to punish, you know, if someone has committed an offense that we really feel is punishable and needs it, you know, why is a 10-year sentence better than a 5-year sentence when a 10-year sentence has an incredibly devastating effect on folks' ability to come home? And I only have to remind your listeners, 95% of the people in our prisons and jails are coming home. So we should really care about whether they're ready to come home and be citizens and live legal.
Here's a listener who writes, among the political far left in the Bay Area, I've seen some very harsh criticism of Orange Is the New Black. Specifically, activist people of color express resentment about the fact that it took a white sympathetic character to get a true prison story adapted for TV. Also, I realize Piper can't speak for Jenji Kohan, but there seems to be a lot of resentment of her for using too many stereotypes of people of color.
Well, Jenji Kohan has said in her interviews that she viewed the story or using the book, the adaptation of the book, as what she describes as a Trojan horse. And what she says quite straightforward is that if she went to any major, you know, entertainment company and said, I want to do a story about poor women of color and elderly women and women who are outside of a certain, like, glam factor, she would never be able to get that story on the air. So she views this character of Piper Chapman that she has created as an adaptation of the book as her quote-unquote Trojan horse. That may be a sad comment on sort of the entertainment industry and what it takes to get a really interesting show made, but, you know, I am very proud of what she's done with the show. I think she's done a really good job within the parameters of our media reality. I do think media justice is really important. I think the question of who gets to make media and who gets to decide what stories are told is incredibly, incredibly important. So I don't discount that at all.
Again, our guest is Piper Kerman. She's the author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. And speaking about race, let's hear one more cut from the show. This is the inmates getting to elect a representative to be on the prison's Women Advisory Council. And two of these inmates are African-American women, and they start making fun of what they call white people issues and imitate what they mockingly think are white women's voices. Here's the clip.
Let's talk about health care, Mackenzie.
Oh, Amanda, I'd rather not. It's not polite.
Well, did you see that wonderful new documentary about the best sushi in the world? Of course, now that I'm vegan, I didn't enjoy it as much as I might have
before.
You
know, I just don't have the time. Chad and I have our yoga workshop, then wine tasting class, and then we have to have really quiet sex every night at 9.
Well, did you hear that piece on NPR about hedge funds?
Amanda, let me ask you. What do you think about my bangs these days? I mean, do you like them straight down, or should I be doing more of a sweep to the side?
Sweep to the side.
Well, there's maybe stereotypical African-American women stereotyping white women, I guess, or something along those lines. How do you respond to that?
I mean, I think that what Genji and her team of writers would say is that they go into stereotypes and try to blow them up. But I think everyone – it's very interesting to me both in the process of putting out the book and also in the process of the show coming out and hearing people's responses to it. Obviously, folks come to the work from all different perspectives. So I've had folks read the book and say, doesn't really seem so bad. Seems like, you know, you got through okay. And I've had other readers come to me and say, what an ordeal. Same book. Really different responses.
Well, books can be Rorschachs, as they say. And Jennifer writes, given the success of your book and the series and the prison advocacy work you have been led to, would you do it all again if you had the choice? And kudos for the education and advocacy work, by the way.
Thanks.
Would you do it again?
If I had the opportunity to go back in time and change my actions, there is no question I would do that. I would not take that bag of money. The show uses humor, and I think it uses it in great ways because I think the show would be unwatchable in many senses without the humor. I think it's really hard to bring people to this content and this subject matter. That said, the experience of incarceration is a horrific one. And regardless of what my own, penalty I may have paid on a personal level, the impact it had on my family and my loved ones is not something that I can ever really sleep at night over. You know, the worry for my family, my parents. Also.
And your present husband became sort of doing time on and wrote about it
absolutely.
And also
families,
became involved in the whole
families,
process.
Families, significant other ones, significant others, children, they do the time. So, you know, every single sentence in incarceration has a ripple effect on many, many other people. The other thing the other reason that if I could go back in time, I would absolutely not carry that money, not take those actions, not do what I did, is because in the course of my incarceration and my friendships with many women whose lives had been ravaged by drug addiction and drug abuse, I recognized my own culpability, even though it may not have been direct, obviously, in those folks. You know, any contribution I made that my actions made to other people's addiction is something I deeply, deeply regret. And so I would unquestionably go back and change that. And I would go back and tell my young self, you know, your actions mean a lot. And I think that's something that young people don't always believe or recognize, and perhaps even more so young women who are perhaps less empowered than other folks. But, you know, all of our actions in the world mean a lot. They have a big impact on other people.
Have you looked into some of the ravages that come from heroin addiction and some of, what the cost is, both personally and
absolutely.
Not only in terms of prison time, but just lives?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's devastating.
Listener writes, hearing Piper talk has a much more serious demeanor than I expected. I admit I haven't read the memoir. Is it funny? Are there things she looks back at her time in prison and laughs about? You just alluded to the fact that, yes, there is humor.
Well, I mean, I would say that humor is an absolutely essential survival skill. So especially behind the walls of a prison or jail in a really horrific setting, there are times when you draw on humor either, you know, privately or with other people. And it's one of the only ways you get through the day. So,
those women were having a good time. I may have been just a part of the adaptation, but you know,
no,
the cut
we heard, of course, you know, there are times when you sit at the lunch table with, you know, the people that you've forged friendships with, and you do, you find something to laugh. Sometimes there are things that if you didn't laugh, you cry. Sometimes there are just things that are totally goofy and funny. Often within the correctional system, there are things that are so bizarre that you have to laugh because otherwise, again, you would cry.
Let's bring Paula on. Paula, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. And Piper, you know, I haven't read your memoirs yet, and I plan on doing, and I definitely will watch your series. I wanted to share with you that I actually look a lot like you. I'm a Caucasian blonde. I was in the L.A. County Jail for 6 months. It was the most horrific time in my entire life, one of which I don't speak much about. Mm-hmm. But you want to know characters, I can give you a host of characters.
Mm-hmm. I believe
I will tell you that I firmly agree with you about the system, and I'm proud of you for your advocacy. I will tell you about one woman who is still in prison for murder. I was in with a lot of murderers, although I was in for a very low-level crime of credit card fraud, stupid. And being in with murderers, I saw things that I'd never seen in my entire life, and I didn't have a privileged life, but fairly much Ozzie and Harriet. And but I'd never seen the kind of violence and anger directed at each other, mm-hmm. as women toward each other. And I had some women of color, this is just one very small experience of violence, come at me and wanted to hurt me. And I had a woman who had just come in, tall. I thought she was 6 feet tall, ended up to be 5'6". And she stood in front of me and protected me from these women. And I never forgot her. And my father said, walk away from that place, never look back. But I didn't. I have supported her for the last, well, since 1998.
All right, Paula, we're getting into a little bit of too much detail here, but I appreciate the story that you related to us, and I thank you. In many instances, when someone is, I suppose, under attack and someone else protects them, then that protector becomes the predator. I mean, that certainly is a story one often hears in male imprisonment. But it reminds me again about the unspoken rules. You don't ask people what they're in for.
No, that is definitely verboten. The best icebreaker in prison is, how much time do you have? but it's interesting. One of the things that is notable to me about the experience of incarceration is that, by and large, you don't necessarily care so much about what offense landed them there. You care a lot more about who they are, because you're going to need to survive sort of cheek by jowl with them. And so there's far more information you need than just that single act.
Quick question from Daniel. I was wondering what life is like for many of these women after prison and the transition from the prison family to life afterwards in the real world. What things can society do to help these men and women adjust back and build healthy and productive lives?
So there are many, as we already touched on, many stumbling blocks or obstacles to coming home successfully and living legal. So employment is, again, and especially for guys, I find more than women, but for all folks returning home from prison and jail, employment is a huge, huge one. So for those who actually have control over things like hiring decisions, actually giving people a chance, a second chance, when it comes to hiring is really, really important. In some places, there is advocacy to, quote unquote, ban the box, which means to take away that little checkbox on a job, you know, application that says, have you been convicted of a felony? there are ways that folks can have their records, if not expunged, you know, can have more details put on their records. But there is a very, very big stigma around hiring people who have a criminal record. And that is probably, you know, the single thing that I would love to see the most focus on. For women coming home from prison, the vast majority of women in prison are mothers, and the majority of them are the mothers of minor children, children under the age of 18. So the separation from those children is very devastating and problematic, and many of those children go into the foster care system. So women coming home from prison, one of the first things that they are most concerned about often is regaining custody of their children. And that can be a source of both either success or, you know, sort of chaos.
Let us leave it there. Piper Kerman, mm-hmm. thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Michael, for having me on.
Great to have you on. Again, Orange is the New Black, My Year in Women's Prison, and it provides the basis for the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. Well, it's time for our listener feedback segment, and we want to read some of your letters and feedback. One of the most commented shows of the past few weeks was our interview with Diane Ravitch, who joined us to discuss her new book, Reign of Error, which is critical of charter schools and privatization movement in education. And Christine wrote, in defense of charter schools, all charter schools must have a sponsoring district. It is the district school board that demands accountability, and they only understand what they currently have in place. Therefore, uniqueness of mission is squashed in favor of academic measures every time. Please stop lumping all charter schools together. Each one has its own mission and is different from one another. And during that same show, a listener made the case that privately run entities like Starbucks run more smoothly than state operations such as the Department of Motor Vehicles. And Bruce had this to say. The Starbucks versus DMV argument is a stupid one. Selling a $4 cup of coffee will always be easier than keeping our road safe. Some things cannot and should not be privatized, schools included. And Bryce wrote in to let us know about his unhappiness with our half-hour shows. Today has been another example of a one-hour program broken into two halves, neither of which allows sufficient listener feedback. Forum seems to me to be heading more in this direction, leading to more superficial discussions. I strongly suggest that the program should focus on one topic and cover it well. Otherwise, what's the point? And many listeners called in to thank us for Tuesday's show on the logistics of death and to share their experiences, good and bad. Michaela shared this tip. Having been an executor many times, the most important parts of all these many issues is to talk about it. The best gift that my mother gave to me was to speak directly and personally with each of my siblings so that they heard from her directly what she did and didn't want, and it made my job as the legally designated agent so much easier and kept all five of us united in caring for her. Thank you for your feedback. If you have something to share, you can email us, forum@kqed.org. All our shows are found online in our archives at forum@kqed.org. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Evelyn Wang, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valla, and Angela Johnston. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.